Welcome to ASAP Nowcast for March 2022. This is Cedric Dark. I'm the medical editor-in-chief for ASAP Now, and I wanted to let you know what's in the magazine this month. We have Resident Innovations in Medicine. We have Skeptic's Guide talking about pigtails versus large bore chest tubes for traumatic hemothorax. We'll talk to you about practicing emergency medicine in New Zealand with an interview I'll do with Dr. Ryan Radecki. And one of our features this month is a little bit about the history of emergency medicine and how it is all explained by dissent. But now, let's move into one of our major items for the month.
First up, I'm going to talk to Dr. Indira Gowda,
an emergency physician at UCLA Medical Center,
and Dr. Nick Jeans,
an emergency physician at NYU Langone Health, clinical associate professor in the Department of Emergency Medicine at NYU Grossman School of Medicine, and chair of ASEP's Health IT Committee,
about the 21st Century Cures Act, rules for patient record access. And then after that, I'm going to talk with Dr. Anya Yor,
an emergency physician affiliated with Providence Regional Medical Center in Everett, Washington,
about the act as well, with some additional commentary.
My interview with Dr. Anya Yor was recorded using a phone line, which means the audio quality isn't the best, but Dr. Yor's comments are. So please give it a listen, and our apologies for the audio quality.
With me now, we have Dr. Indira Gowda, one of the doctors that was interviewed for our article about the 21st Century Cures Act. And I wanted to get your impression, first of all, about what you think about the situation where now our physician notes are immediately available to the patient. And what does that mean for the average emergency physician?
I think overall, this is a good thing that patients have more access to their data. And I think this is going to empower patients and help them make more informed decisions. I think in the ER setting, patients having access to this data in real time can create some difficulties for the providers and the patients in trying to understand all of that data and interpret it in real time. And, you know, I think that the concern is that we want to give patients access to their information, but in a meaningful way. And, you know, so I think that this certainly can provide a lot of opportunities for discussion between providers and patients, but we certainly need to also allocate the time to have that discussion. And sometimes the ER is just a really busy environment where I think we're somewhat constrained in having that time to have these meaningful discussions around this data.
Well, you bring up a very good point, Dr. Gowda, and I think this is reflected in a survey that went out where 60% of emergency docs said that they have had an experience where a patient wound up seeing either their labs or their imaging results prior to the physician. And has this happened to you? Is there a memorable situation that you recall where a patient may have seen their results before you did?
So this has happened to me a few times. Thankfully, it hasn't been anything devastating to the patient. It's usually things like blood work that comes back, and the patient will update me about their results before I've often even had a chance to take a look at it. So in some ways, that's a good thing because they can let me know that the results are already back. Sometimes patients get caught up in certain lab values that we as emergency physicians do not pay as much attention to, such as, like, you know, if you're getting a CBC, they may be concerned about the RDW values. And that's something as an ER doc, I feel like the last time I thought about that was med school. And so, you know, sometimes you have to have a little bit more conversation about, well, these are the values we actually care about and that are meaningful for your care. And these are the ones we don't pay attention to as much. And so those like red values or the flags next to some of these values indicating they're too high or low isn't something that should concern or worry someone. However, we did send out a survey to a lot of our ASAP members, and we got some, you know, interesting responses in that some people, patients, did have access to their information in real time, and they learned some very devastating results via having this access in real time. Like one patient who came in for first trimester vaginal bleeding had an ultrasound done, and the ultrasound showed that there was no viable pregnancy. And so that's how she found out that she had a miscarriage and it wasn't the provider having that conversation with her. And I think that that is certainly a concern with, giving patients access to this data in not having it in the right context where, certain results such as that should be, I think, relayed to a patient via a human being and not a computer.
Yeah, and that's certainly a devastating situation in a way where the 21st Century Cures Act fails us as physicians because we don't have the ability to counsel our patients. Let's bring in Dr. Nick Jeans as well. And sort of the same question for you here, have you had an experience where a patient has received the results before you did? And what has that been like for you practicing?
A lot like what Indira, Dr. Gowda is saying, nothing awful like that example we found in the survey, but plenty of occasions where the patient seems, focused on trivia, minutia, not the reason why they're in the emergency department, not something that's actually worrisome, the RDW, the potassium is a little bit off, et cetera. And I find myself now a little bit on the defensive, catching up because they know something that I haven't had a chance to review yet. And it is a good thing that patients are informed and that they have access to the results and they have access to our notes. We've seen lots of evidence from the outpatient setting where, this kind of engagement, this kind of awareness has led to, better adherence to medications, better understanding of plans. So I think it's a good thing, and I'm glad that it has come to the emergency department as well. However, it's just sometimes, especially when you have a very limited opportunity for interaction, you want to have that conversation be focused on like the appropriate sort of stuff and not necessarily, lab trivia. And so I do have some experience seeing that on a few occasions.
You've argued that the federal government should allow a delay in releasing data, especially as it pertains to the ER, for maybe 24 hours or at least until the ER visit is over. And to me that sounds like a very reasonable idea. How has your advocacy on that issue progressed?
I'll say we're fortunate with ASAP. We have capable representation and access to leaders in the Office of the National Coordinator for Health IT, and they've been receptive, and they understand that there can be some unintended consequences occasionally, and they were very interested in the survey that ASAP conducted last summer, where we collected a lot of these anecdotes, and we had some data as well. They are satisfied, first and foremost, that there are exclusions to this sharing. And one example I can think of just recently, there was an intimate partner violence sort of situation where the patient was there with the spouse, and when the spouse would walk away, the patient would tell us, disturbing, concerning sort of things. And one of the things was also that, the spouse had access to the medical record. So we were savvy and smart enough to disable note sharing when we were writing specific notes about, this patient's risks. These are encoded in the law and in the guidance from the ONC, and this is important to remember that we don't have to share if we think the patient's health is at stake. However, for a lot of these other unintended consequences that we're discussing, talking about the lab results or confusion about language, et cetera. I do think it makes sense. This was a law, I think, originally intended for outpatient care. And when you have a chance to discuss in advance with patients what you're expecting to order, what you're expecting to find, and then discussing those results and prepping the patients, which is not always possible in the emergency department. So I do think it makes sense to delay the release of those notes and that data until the end of the visit. The Office of the National Coordinator they can appreciate our perspective, but I think they're really looking to mobilize that data, first share it with the patients as the law intends, as soon as possible. But also, I think they're looking to develop an app economy, as I've heard them say in some cases, where as soon as the patient gets the data, they can forward it to third parties if they're interested, forward it to families or other people that they want to share it with. They want the patient to be empowered to work with this data as soon as it's available. They're not necessarily interested in delays for the emergency department. They don't want us to be able to introduce any systematic delays. They would actually call that obstruction. When we spoke with ONC, they were amenable to a patient-centered approach where the patient would actually consent to have their information delayed until the time of discharge, which does seem like a nice compromise.
Yeah.
Currently, I don't think any electronic health record vendor has this kind of possibility. When you're at triage in the ED, you can opt to have your data delayed, till the end of the visit. It's sort of like a theoretical thing. We can talk with the vendors and maybe develop something, but then it would still be what patient would opt into that. Depends on how it's phrased, I guess.
With me now, Dr. Anya Yor.
And thanks for participating in this interview. You mentioned something very interesting. I like the language that you used. You said there's always been this veil of mystery around physician notes, and that it was like hard for patients to see what we were talking about. Can you explore that a little bit? Tell the listeners what you meant by that.
Absolutely, Cedric, and thank you for having me here. Historically speaking, physicians have tried to keep themselves a little bit at an arm's length from patients. You know, back in the old days, of course, physicians would literally speak Latin at the bedside in order to exclude the patient from the conversation. That practice continued in somewhat more modern form with the medical record. Patients traditionally were not allowed to see their own medical records. And if they did have a need to see them, whether it was transferring care to another provider or any sort of malpractice litigation, there was a lot of barriers and obstacles that were deliberately raised to make it difficult for patients to get their medical records. They would have to go to the medical records department and pay a fee and wait for 6 weeks. I think it's difficult to understate how much the 21st Century Cures Act has transformed the medical record in terms of the transparency and availability to patients.
Some physicians think that could come with some liability increases. ACEP did a survey, 70% of ER docs think that with patients being able to see what we write in real time, liability will increase. I want to know, do you agree with that assessment or not?
I don't. I'll say straight up that transparency is probably one of the greater protections against liability that we have. If you look at lawsuits, and if you look at surveys they've done of patients who have filed a malpractice claim, only a small percentage of people did so because they actually wanted to get money. A majority of people filed a malpractice claim either because they didn't like the doctor or because they felt like that they were being lied to. They felt like the medical establishment was trying to cover up something that maybe didn't go as well as it could have. Patients having access to that information literally at their fingertips, I think, will do more to reduce the risk of liability than it ever would to increase it. And that's not to say it comes without some pitfalls that we need to be mindful of, and I'm sure we're going to talk about that in terms of the language we use and how we refer to patients. We do need to be careful, but I certainly see this as a net positive, both for communication with patients, but also for malpractice risk reduction.
You mentioned this in regards to what are known as incidentalomas, things that you find on a CAT scan that might not be why the patient's here, but something that might need to follow up. And it sounds like you think that by patients knowing about this, it'll actually benefit them in the long run and be less likely to wind up in some form of litigation for, let's say, someone missing an early cancer or something along those lines.
Right. I think some of that is perhaps an unintended consequence of this act, but it is going to force us to be a little more honest and a little more scrupulous in terms of how we communicate with patients. I know many times in the past, the emergency physician may have seen some little granuloma or on a chest x-ray or something, and they just forgot to mention it. It wasn't that they deliberately chose not to mention it. It escaped their mind. And now, given that we know the patient is going to have access to their radiology reports, and they're going to have access to their labs, and in fact, oftentimes they have already seen their report by the time we're back at the bedside, that knowledge that the patient has this information is going to induce physicians to be more conscientious about discussing it with the patient and saying, yeah, we did see this, and this is what it means, and this is what you have to do about it. 90% of the time, it's just housekeeping, but it's keeping us a little more honest about doing the due diligence that we should have been doing all along.
So, Dr. Yore, any final thoughts that you want to tell the listeners of ACIP Nowcast?
I think, Cedric, a lot of physicians have been very anxious about this change. It is very transformative in terms of the relationship between physicians and patients. But I would encourage our listeners not to be anxious, but to embrace it. I see a lot of physicians who are putting little disclaimers in their notes. And while that's all fine and good, I think that this isn't something we should shy away from. We don't need to change what we're doing fundamentally. We don't need to abandon the medical language that we've used. Medical language is important because it's precise and because it's concise in terms of creating a document of what happened. Patients aren't stupid. Patients will read this and they will understand it, particularly the more health literate people that are going to take the time and effort to look at their chart. It's okay to communicate and to document as we always have. The one point that I would really implore physicians to consider is the language we use and the way it may reflect our biases. It has always been a struggle to use value-neutral language, particularly when we're dealing with patients who may belong to marginalized groups or may suffer from stigmatized conditions, mental health, or substance use disorder. I've always said you shouldn't put something in a chart if you'd be embarrassed to see it blown up on a 5x9 poster at a malpractice trial. And now that's going to apply to every chart. Every chart is going to be subject to that type of scrutiny. We should strive to understand our biases and strive to make sure that those don't slip through into our documentation. And I think that's the most important point for physicians to consider when they think about how this may change the way we document.
All right, so let's circle back. Dr. Gowda, any final thoughts that you want to leave with the listeners of ACIP Nowcast about what they should know about the 21st Century Cures Act?
I think it's important to know that it's here, sharing information with patients. It's not probably going away. I think it's important as providers that we write our notes knowing that patients are going to be viewing these notes as well. So that may change how we state certain things. Overall, I think we, as providers, should still be focused on our notes having value for other providers as well. I think that we are going to have to find the balance between making our notes amenable towards patients, but also meaningful for other providers. We will continue to see how we can achieve that balance.
Dr. Jeans, any thoughts that you want to leave the ACIP member emergency physician with?
I think most emergency physicians know if they're practicing in a department where the patients have a lot of access or not. And certainly I rotate through several emergency departments and there's a lot of variability. But when I'm working in a department where a lot of the patients have portal access and they're plugged in, I definitely change my characteristic discussions with patients, and I want them to know up front the tests that I'm ordering, why I'm ordering them. It's good practice to do always, but I've learned that the patients appreciate it when they have a heads up about what's coming.
Thank you all very much. To Dr. Yore, thank you. Dr. Jeans, thank you. And Dr. Gowda, thank you for talking with us this month on ACIP Nowcast.
Let's come together for ACIP's Leadership and Advocacy Conference to celebrate emergency medicine's accomplishments and continue to work for a better political environment for emergency medicine and for our patients. We'll tackle problems facing our specialty, develop tools to advocate at all levels, and build relationships with your members of Congress, all while having a great time. Join us in D.C. May 1st through May 3rd. With me now, Dr. Jamie Kuo, who is on the front cover of ACIP Now. And I think you went from not knowing too much about health policy to being on the cover of the magazine sharing your story. So how's that feel?
I like to make waves, man. I like to make waves. I always joke that I am more of an executive producer, so I like to do stuff in the background. So it is a little weird. But anything that I can do to bring awareness to the cause is fine with me. I'm willing to do it.
All right. Well, it's good work that you did. You tell us about the story of HB 495. This is a bill in Louisiana that would have allowed full practice authority for advanced practice registered nurses. Why do you feel like you had to stop that bill?
I had always been aware of this possibility of independent practice. I had been hearing about it since I was in medical school, but I didn't really pay attention to legislation. And over the years, I've worked with a lot of nurse practitioners, a lot of physician's assistants. They are my colleagues. They're my friends. I train them and I work very closely with them. And I just have found that the collaborative model, working with them, working with a few of them, being able to oversee them during fast track shifts and sometimes even main side shifts, I have found that collaborative model is the most effective model. So the reason why I got involved last year was because in the entire history of Louisiana, as many times as these bills had been introduced, the bill had never left the initial committee that it was introduced, whether it was introduced on the Senate side or the House side. And so it came out of committee and I was still just going, mm. And then it went to the House floor and the vote was like 80 to 60. It was an overwhelming vote. It wasn't even close. And I was like, oh my goodness. And just one day I was watching it on my computer. I think just I had been paying attention to other political stuff, the other bills that I had been interested in. And I was at work going, oh my gosh, this bill's going to pass. Like it had passed so easily through the House that I said, you know, I pondered on it. And I went and talked to a few of my partners about it. I was like, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? And I just decided that day, I said, I'm going to do something about this. Nobody else is going to do it. We're all asleep. Physicians are busy. I just thought about it. I said, you know what? I have time to do it. I'm going to do it. And that's why I did it. So that day is the day that I started this Facebook group, which I'm not even really that active on Facebook, but I was like, I went on a Facebook. Facebook groups are amazing. Started the group. I started inviting all my friends and I just started this whole campaign and found a few partners in crime and we just took off within days.
Tell me about that a little bit because the train had left the station already. You said this bill's through the House, so it just has to get through the other side of the legislature and then it could be law. So how did you generate enough energy to stop what was already rolling down the train tracks?
Okay, so I started the Facebook group and just started inviting all my friends. I went on and started making announcements. It's like we have a physician's mom group, a local group that we go to. I went on there and said, hey, everybody, like y'all join. Interestingly, a plastic surgeon in town who has become one of my partners in crime on this, she had the same feeling that same day and said, we're going to do something about it. So she and her sister, who lives in North Louisiana, started their own Facebook group. So we had these two parallel Facebook groups that were started the same day because we both had this sense of urgency. And when I saw that their group was formed, I joined it and I just immediately reached out to her. I said, hey, you have this group, I have this group, let's work together. So we ended up talking on the phone the next day and saying, all right, this is my plan, this is your plan, and this is what we got to do. And I then ASAP and even the Louisiana State Medical Society or different societies will put out those Autobots that you can just fill out your name and it'll send stuff out to people. Right. I took one of those links. I think our state medical society had it. And I literally went down every single physician in my phone. I took a few hours that evening, went down every physician in my phone and just started texting them. And more than half of them replied. Some people, you just don't hear from them because again, they're a little sleepy. But so I did that. I think I started the Facebook group on Monday and Tuesday, spoke to Summer Black on Wednesday. Thursday night, she calls me. And she says, look, she was feeling really nervous. She said, what do people do when they want to stop a bill? And she turned to her husband, who's also a physician, so they're both physicians. She said, what do they do? What do they do? He said, they hire a lobbyist. We found a lobbyist. He talked to his lawyer, put him in touch with a lobbyist. And a Summer called me that night. This was Thursday night. And she said, hey, a few surgeons and I are trying to raise money. We're going to hire a lobbyist. That's what we're told that we need to do to get our voice out because we're working during the day. So we need to hire somebody to get our message across and we're going to hire a lobbyist. It's going to cost $50,000 and I've already raised about $25,000. I said, Summer, stop right there. I'm off tomorrow and I'm going to raise the rest of the money. The next morning I happened to be off. I raised the majority of that money by noon. And I happened to text Mike Smith. He's our current ASAP president. Said, hey, do you have money to donate? We're trying to hire this lobbyist. We're trying to do whatever we can do. He was, I think that we can approve ASAP on an emergent basis. So he got on it and he pulled together a board meeting by that afternoon. And I knew by 5 p.m. on Friday, so less than 24 hours after speaking to Summer, that we had raised the other $25,000. And by that evening, we had hired the lobbyist.
That's pretty amazing. You guys able to put down $50,000 in a week to do some advocacy.
24 hours, Cedric. 20-
24 hours, sorry. 24 hours.
International Women's Day, so I just need to bring to attention that it was two women that raised it. I just wanted to make you aware of that.
Very good, very good.
To me, and from when we talked about this at it seemed like this sparked your passion for state advocacy. So what's going on next session? Because Louisiana is about to re-enter the legislative session in a couple of weeks, I think.
This session starts on the 14th. So a few ER doctors and I have been meeting regularly, pretty much weekly on Zoom. That's Etch and Debbie. And we have just been planning for this. We recently hired a lobbyist. We're raising money again right now. We're doing it a little slower because we have a little more time. Our lobbyist actually just brought to our attention 17 medically related bills. They literally just emailed us the list. I want to say it was yesterday or the day before. So we have split up the bills, the 17 bills. The three of us are going to split them up. Tomorrow's our state meeting. We'll probably discuss it that day. And then we have a Zoom meeting with our lobbyists on Thursday to talk about which bills that we're interested in. The nurse practitioners and the physician's assistants did introduce more independent practice bills this year. So we know that those will be our top two bills to pay attention to.
All right. Good luck with that. It looks like the battle is on once again. And one thing, just we're going to wrap up here quickly on ASAP Nowcast, but one thing that you want to tell someone listening to this, how would they go about getting involved in their own state?
You just have to do it. I think the first thing that you do is reach out to your local rep, reach out to your local senator. If you're nervous about meeting with them, I know that I was. I didn't have any training. I didn't have any experience. I was like, what do I talk about? I found a family doctor in town who has been really into it. I was like, hey, let's meet with our rep. And we did. So we just messaged her. They all have their legal assistants. And we said, hey, we want to meet with her regarding solutions. And look, this is not just about stopping these bills. And I actually don't even really like to call it a battle. It's us pushing for good legislation. It's us trying to explain to our representatives. And that's a big reason why I got involved in this, was I felt responsible to educate my reps. That's what I'm there for. They're not doctors. My rep is a realtor. I don't expect her to understand how independent practice is going to affect her patient, you know, or her constituents or my patients. So it's my responsibility to explain that to her. And that's what we did. I literally just started sending out emails, and one day I was voting and I saw her in line. I said, oh my God, I just messaged you. And then while we were talking, another rep walked by. So we started talking to her. And then I just started following different representatives on social media. Another rep started following me back. So this is like the third rep. I've been reaching out to different friends and saying, hey, who do you know? And a lot of people went to high school with these people, or middle school, or their children go to the same school. And I just say, hey, let's meet up with them. Let's make a plan. So today, actually, I made plans with a fellow ER doctor. We talked about it at work. We're going to drive to Baton Rouge one day and actually try to meet up with one of the senators who actually introduced the nurse practitioner bill this year. You just got to do it. Start casting out the nets and see what you can catch.
All right. Well, great. Thanks for joining us on ASAP Nowcast.
All right, everybody. Thank you so much for listening to this month's March 2022 edition of ASAP Nowcast. And thank you to our guests, Dr. Indira Gowda, Dr. Nick Jeans, Dr. Anya Yore, Dr. Jamie Kuo, for joining us today. And stay tuned for the April issue of ASAP Now. We're going to have a therapeutics update regarding COVID-19 and many other articles that will be interesting and educational for you. Until next time.
ASAP Now is published by Wiley and is a product of the American College of Emergency Physicians. The views expressed on ASAP Nowcast are those of the hosts and any guests. The music is Florence Price's Fantasy No. 1 in G minor for violin and piano.